This is the TTY Dialer, episode 29 for the week of May 15th through May 20th. Hi there, welcome to your weekly companion to WRVO's old-time radio show tuned to yesterday. I'm Mark Livonier. Every night of the week, I bring you comedy, drama, mystery, adventure, science fiction, westerns, and more from radio's golden era. It's from 10 to midnight, live on the air, or through our website, wrvo.org. And in this podcast, I bring you what's coming up for the week on the show, radio history, fun with sound from radio's past, and sometimes with these sounds, we're brought on a
strange adventure.
Marcel Leclerc, concertmaster of the Paris Opera, closed his violin case after the highly successful concert, bade goodnight to his fellow musicians, and stepped out of the stage door. He hailed a cab that was waiting at the curb of the dimly lighted street. The next day, he failed to show up at the theater. He had disappeared as suddenly and as mysteriously as if the night had swallowed him up. The police were baffled, and even the crack detectives of the famous Sûreté Nationale were unable to find the slightest trace. All Paris was combed. Newspapers ran his picture, but no clues were turned up. Leclerc had no enemies and carried very little money, so the possibility of foul play was ruled out. All his personal effects were searched, and friends were questioned. Everything possible was done to account for a voluntary disappearance, but no evidence was uncovered. Years later, Paul Ardu, a French explorer, and his native porters were paddling up the wildest reaches of the Mater River in the heart of the Venezuelan jungle. Suddenly, they heard the distant but clear notes of a violin. The native, stricken with fear of the unknown, refused to paddle further. The canoe put in at the bank, and the explorer and his men stepped ashore and made their way through the thick jungle. Soon the melody of the mysterious violinist became more distinct. Ardu recognized the melody as one he had heard often in the theaters and concert halls of Paris. He was baffled. Here was concert music in the heart of one of the wildest jungles of the world. He knew that no man short of a genius was drawing the bow. The explorer halted, peered through the trees, then stood awestruck at what he had seen. Standing in the little clearing was a tall, sun-bronzed white man playing a violin. The hair of the stranger was long and matted and fell down about his shoulders. A white bushy beard covered his chest. He swayed gently, eyes closed, as he wooed a haunting melody from the violin. Ardu gasped, for despite the long hair and beard, he recognized the missing concertmaster. He and the violinist had been friends years ago, close friends. He stepped into the clearing and almost shouted, "Marcel Leclerc!" The musician stopped playing, opened his eyes wide in fear and surprise. He turned to the white intruder who was now coming to meet him.
"Oui, I am Marcel Leclerc."
A look of recognition came over the worn face.
"But Paul, what are you doing here?"
The two men sat down upon the trunk of a fallen tree to talk. The musician smiled.
"You must forgive my lack of attire. I live with the Indians, and clothing is quite unnecessary. Come to my hut, and I'll tell you of my life here."
And right here in the episode would be the local commercial insert for stations carrying the Strange Adventure syndicated series, basically provided to stations to have a unique short show to invite sponsors to get in on as a way to pitch their product. And the narrator in the over 250 episodes produced by the Teleways Company was actor Pat McGeehan. He was often heard on the air in a wide variety of shows from the early 1940s, and one time he was a stand-in for Detective Bruce Lance on the air. He starred as leading man in the soap opera Aunt Mary, and he was also chief announcer on the Red Skelton Show. His range behind the mic suited Strange Adventure well with his voice characterizations for every single story, including the one we've been listening to called The Jungle Mystery.
Leclerc never talked of his mysterious disappearance. But one day, Ardu found a small gold locket containing a tiny photograph of a beautiful girl, a girl who had jilted Leclerc to marry another. And the girl in the photograph was Ardu's wife.
This is Pat McGeehan saying goodbye from my writer Charles Crowder and inviting you to listen again to another tale of
Strange Adventure.
This Monday night, May 15th, on Tune to Yesterday at 10 o'clock, Mystery, with episodes of Suspense and yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Then it's an hour of Westerns, with broadcasts of The Frontier Gentleman and Fort Laramie, with Raymond Burr. This Tuesday, May 16th at 10, it's comedy from Groucho Marx on his radio show Blue Ribbon Town, then the Academy Award Theater from 1946. At 11, True History with Adventures and Research, then Norman Corwin's powerful series called An American in England from 1942.
Our side doesn't have to jam the Axis. Lord Haw Haw can babble all night on the Allied air if he's a mind to. Nobody here or in the States would waste a radio transmitter's time and energy smudging out the bray of a fascist ass. Come to think of it, the Axis has very little imagination. If the British wanted to jam anybody, they'd at least do it with sounds appropriate to whoever was being jammed, the jammee. For instance, Hitler.
Hear these shows Monday, May 15th and Tuesday, May 16th from 10 to midnight on Tune to Yesterday. The intellectual radio quiz show Information Please made its debut this Wednesday, May 17th in 1938, and would go on to be a mainstay on the air for over a decade. It was hosted by the well-respected author and literary critic Clifton Fadiman, who had a matter-of-fact manner on the air, though genial, that really seemed perfect when he was moderating some of the sharper minds of the day on the show. And his well-rounded interests in everything from mathematics to limericks helped with some commentary on the responses from a four-person panel. And though he had a fairly commanding presence, he was blindsided by the success of Information Please, doubting that he would even make it past his audition as the host. Fadiman once said that for most men, life is a search for the proper manila envelope in which to get themselves filed. And though he didn't expect it, he became filed in the category of a pioneer in radio hosting, as the show was an instant hit. His panel consisted of columnist Franklin P. Adams and the affluent writer John Kieran, and in many broadcasts, the piano virtuoso and intellectual humorist Oscar Levant. The panel would answer questions sent in by listeners, and if they were able to stump the experts, a set of encyclopedias, a small cash amount, and during the Second World War, war bonds were given out as prizes. By the end of its first season, Information Please enjoyed a listenership of close to 10 million on Tuesday nights at 8:30, later moving to NBC's primetime slot on Friday nights. And it wasn't just the meeting of the minds or wit that attracted people to the show, but also the gamut of celebrity guests that were featured every week. Authors, musicians, entertainers like Alfred Hitchcock, Basil Rathbone, Gracie Allen, even the silent performer Harpo Marx, who during one episode whistled his way through it. Clifton Fadiman summarized the series best when he said that Information Please was a perfect mixture of bright interest and delicate malice that spurs the experts to do their desperate best. Now, many regarded this formula as the perfect type of quiz show, and with that, here's some sound from the series with the author of the Nero Wolfe novels, Rex Stout, as celebrity guest.
The next question from E. Leonard Kalm of Morrisville, Pennsylvania, has to do with crime, rather with detectives. Now, there are various odd ways of making a living, and one of the oddest is writing detective stories, isn't it, Mr. Stout?
Yes.
Mr. Stout has made crime pay, and I'm going to ask Mr. Stout and also his colleagues this evening to identify the following fictional detectives who have appeared very successfully in a series of books or on the screen. I want you to name one fictional detective who is usually aided by his father, Mr. Van Doren. What were you going to say?
I really should let that go, Stout.
Well, we'll try him again. Mr. Stout?
Ellery Queen.
Ellery Queen, yes. So who is his father? Do you remember?
Father is a police inspector in New York City.
Name is Queen.
Name is Queen, yes. That makes everything okay. And I'd hate to ask you to mention the actual titles of books by one of your rivals, Mr. Stout, but could you name one or two of Mr. Queen's books? Excellent books they are, aren't they?
The Adventures of Ellery Queen.
It's a good trick. You might remember that sometime for a title yourself.
I've read every one of them, Mr. Fadiman.
Are they all right?
They're good detectives.
All right, yes. Yeah. Some others are the Roman Hat Mystery, the American...
The Gracie Allen Murder.
The Gracie Allen Murder. I think it was S.S. Van Dyne, Mr. Adam.
Was it?
The Greek Cross Mystery.
The Greek Cross Mystery. That's a very bloody one. I remember that distinctly. It kept me up for 3 or 4 minutes.
Of course, there were some others that appeared under another name.
Were they really, Mr. Van Dyne? I didn't know that.
Oh, I've been told.
I thought you were a literary critic. You mustn't let these things out.
All
the
right.
Craft doesn't allow it. You know?
I cheat.
And while we're on the subject of fictional detectives, Can you name one who has been aided by his son occasionally? We have one who was aided by his father in his work, one who has been aided by his son. It's a very famous one. Aided by his son?
In more than one book, Mr. Cradham?
Well, it's a series of books, yes.
You mean the detective?
Yes,
or the writer?
That's right. The detective has been aided by his son. And the series of books in which this detective appears, I think that series has been screened very successfully. Mr. Vandar.
Charlie Chan.
Quite right. Charlie Chan. Charlie Chan was aided by his son.
They sprung a second son, too, in the film. I resent it.
That's so?
But pardon me, Mr. Fatima. Not in any of his books was he aided by his son, except that his son laced up his shoes or something for him. He may have been in the movie.
That's a help. That's a help.
That's a big help.
Certainly. As a matter of fact, if Charlie Chan were as fat as your detective, Nero Wolfe, having someone...
He'd have to have several sons to lace up his shoes.
And the boys have a chance to grow up now.
Name a fictional detective who is aided by his secretary. Mr. Stout.
Perry Mason.
Perry Mason, yes. Has a secretary, Della Street, who knows all the answers. Very cute kid, too. Does anyone help Nero Wolfe in your own series of stories, Mr. Stout?
I do, pretty often.
You do often. The next question from Robert B. Jackson of this city. A very simple question. You ought to know the answer to it right off the reel. Which two candidates for the vice presidency of the United States who ran against each other both became presidents of the United States? Mr. Kieran.
I think Jefferson and Adams.
No, I don't think so.
Well, they were all candidates.
Of course, they did both become presidents, but I don't think they ran against each other for vice president. Mr. Van Doren, can your memory help us out there?
In those days, the one who
got... There was only one party, I think.
The one who got the most votes was president, and the one who got next was vice president.
That's right. Well, then they are not running against each other for vice president.
All right, officer, I'll go quietly.
All right, Mr. Kieran. Hate to argue with you, Mr. Kieran. There's only one possible answer, and I'm rather surprised you don't know it. Calvin Coolidge and Franklin D. Roosevelt opposed each other in 1920, members of the Harding versus Cox. Remember that? And, of course, both became president later on. Well, that loses $10 for us, courtesy of Canada Dry, going out to Mr. Jackson of the city.
This Wednesday night, May 17th, on Tuned to Yesterday at 10 o'clock, it's science fiction, episodes of Exploring Tomorrow and Escape. Then it's an hour of crime at 11 with Let George Do It and High Adventure.
This is High Adventure. At this meeting, Inside Story, a big city tale written and directed especially for High Adventure by Robert Monroe. It concerns three people, two of whom wanted to live and the other wouldn't die. Inside Story, as told by the man it happened to, a man called Jim Hannigan. His moment of high adventure.
This Thursday, May 18th at 10 o'clock, drama from the Lux Radio Theater, adapting the movie This Above All. Then it's horror with broadcasts of Lights Out and Suspense. Hear these programs Wednesday, May 17th and Thursday, May 18th from 10 to midnight, live on the air on Tune to Yesterday or live online at WRVO.org. And don't forget, we do have that second stream of old-time radio running on WRVO2, which you can listen to right off of the website. That's on every single night from 8 to 10. So if you wanted to, you could listen to Tune to Yesterday for 4 hours straight, if you could stand it. One of radio's longer-lasting crime shows made its debut this Thursday, May 18th, in 1942, Counterspy, which starred Don McLaughlin as Agent David Harding, featured stories of espionage, intrigue, and crime-solving at the federal level, at home and abroad. And it was created by Phillips H. Lord, a big name in crime broadcasting, as he worked as host and director on the wildly popular shows Mr. District Attorney and Gangbusters in the late 1930s and early 40s. It was reportedly due to some conflicts with FBI head J. Edgar Hoover over some scripts for Gangbusters that inspired Lord to develop his own series about international justice and created Counterspy. In his time with Gangbusters, he had access to a lot of case files and knowledge from the FBI, and was able to build up his base of story ideas that he would see through on his new show. In its start, the show was fairly popular, and one time even on 3 days a week, but it really didn't hit its stride until after the Second World War, where crime stories from the home front in the wake of the fighting and the Cold War were becoming more popular, Like on its sister shows, This Is Your FBI and The FBI in Peace and War. Counterspy even proved itself to be a realistic program when, in one episode, they dramatized racketeers preying on families who lost their sons and daughters to the war just days before a national-level racketeering bust took place, causing somewhat of a scandal at the time with the on-air prediction. Within the hundreds of programs produced for both ABC and NBC, the characters, in a way, played out some of the fears people had in the threats and criminal schemes in a post-war America, but were comforted, too, by the procedural and, at times, clever solutions in the weekly plays. Here's some sound from their seventh season on the air from the episode called The Case of the Murdered Millions.
Now, do you pay off or do I give the word?
I'd still like more proof.
Okay.
No, wait a minute. Don't go.
I don't like to waste my time.
I know how rumors can spread. Every now and then, from nowhere, comes the rumor that some famous person is dead.
So?
Let's pick a name. Say, Bert Clancy, the baseball player. He's in good health. If I hear he's dead from some public source, then we can do business.
That's not bad, Mr. Sanford. In fact, it's good enough for me to file for future use.
Then it's a deal?
Yeah. And when you hear Clancy's dead, call me. I'll come around to collect my first quarterly retainer.
Mr. Norman?
Yes?
This is Colton Sanford. I just heard a rumor that Bert Clancy died.
So did I. Funny how those things start, isn't it?
Isn't it? Incidentally, we've decided to retain your firm for public relations.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
If you'll drop around our conference room in about an hour, our vice president in charge of personnel will outline the company policies.
Oh?
And, of course, give you your first quarterly retainer.
Splendid. I'll be very interested in learning the company policy.
1 hour, then. Goodbye.
Right in here, Mr. Norman. I'm sorry Mr. Sanford was called away.
He left a note about the retainer, I
hope. Oh, naturally. We'll pick it up in accounting. After you've seen the orientation film, we like to show all new executives.
Well, let's get to it, then.
Of course. Oh, this is Mr. Thurman. He'll run the projector and interpret.
Hello?
How do you do? Or shall we start?
Well, I'm expecting to... Oh, that must be they. Excuse me. Come in.
After you, Rocky.
Now, listen, I don't want to... Norman.
What? Mr. Dunn.
You know each other?
Well, yes, but I wasn't aware that Mr. Dunn was connected with your company.
I thought he was connected with your firm.
Hey, what is this double talk? Don't you know who this guy is, Norman?
I don't think I got the name.
I didn't give it, but it's Harding, David Harding.
Now, the counter spies, Norman. This is some kind of a pinch.
Keep quiet, Mr. Dunn. I'm sure Mr. Harding will explain the meaning of this himself.
With pleasure. But first, I'd like you to look at some moving pictures, Mr. Norman. Peters, will you turn out the lights and stay with Rocky?
Right, Chief.
Thurman, start the projector.
Yes, sir.
Recognize yourself, Mr. Norman?
Yes. I must say I photograph better than Mr. Sanford.
Hey, look, I don't...
Quiet, Rocky.
I thought silent pictures were passé. Well,
not always. Notice this next shot, the way the camera zooms in for a close-up. Telephoto lens.
Ah, yes, huh? Now, this is all very interesting. Is there any point?
Definitely, Mr. Norman. I'm arresting you for extortion, criminal slander, and whatever other counts we can dig up against you.
On the basis of this film?
Yes.
It's silent, Mr. Harding. I was discussing legitimate business with Mr. Sanford when you took them. And if he says different, he's a liar.
The pictures say different. You'll notice how Mr. Sanford kept moving around to keep your face toward one of our cameras. That had a purpose.
I don't bluff easy, Mr. Harding.
You don't have to. I told you Mr. Thurman was the interpreter. What's Norman saying on the screen now, Thurman?
I've got an organization behind me.
one of the biggest syndicates in the country, the Syndicate of Rocky Dunn.
What?
That's how we picked Rocky up.
Smart guy, huh, Norman? You blabbering little no-good.
Hold him, Peter. Cut it, Rocky.
I'll show you. You fool, don't you see it's a trick?
They call it asking for it, Rocky. Rocky always had a reputation for a quick trigger temper.
Now, look here, Mr. Harding.
Well, why don't you give it up, Norman? Mr. Thurman is a lip reader.
Lip reader?
Yes, and he'll appear in court, together with a dozen other expert lip readers, to testify to every word you said.
On top of which, we've got Rocky, and there's a pickup order out for his girlfriend, Dot, to round out our case.
Lip reader?
That's right, Norman. Come on, Peters, let's get him to headquarters. Looks like that's the only way we'll convince him this arrest is not a rumor, but a fact.
This Friday night on Tune to Yesterday, an hour of sitcoms with William Bendix as Riley in The Life of Riley, then Ronald and Benita Coleman in The Halls of Ivy.
A red capsule for breakfast, a white capsule for lunch, a blue capsule for dinner.
And for political banquets, all of them. And three cheers for the red, white, and blue. Anyway, there won't be any more jokes about the bride's biscuits.
No, the comedians will have to modernize.
Mm.
They'll do things like, Mary has a little lamb and thinks that it perhaps will end its days like beef and ham compressed into a capsule.
At 11 o'clock Friday night, Adventure with Stars in the Air and Dangerous Assignment. Then on Saturday, it's Romance at 10 o'clock from the Radio City Playhouse. And the show Romance from 1954 with an all-star cast. At 11 the Saturday, Comedy from the Lux Radio Theater, bringing us the movie Standing Room Only from 1944. Hear these shows Friday, May 19th, and Saturday, May 20th, from 10 to midnight on Tune to Yesterday, live on the air or on the website as we're streaming live at WRVO.org. So last week and the week before, I asked you to send me your top three radio shows on a desert island, and I did get some responses. Thanks a lot for taking the time to write in. A listener of the show, Toby, says, "My favorite show without a doubt is the Phil Harris Alice Faye Show, consistently laugh out loud funny. Also, an endlessly fascinating show is Vic and Sade, definitely Desert Island for me. But the third place could be a ton of shows." I agree, Toby. That's sort of the way it is for me, too. Thanks a lot for writing in. Also heard from Chuck, who said, "If I were lost on a deserted island with just three programs to listen to, it would be You Bet Your Life, simply because of Groucho Marx's incredibly humorous, fast wit, and the amazing way he connects with and relates to his guests. Next would be The Six Shooter, because I'm a tremendous fan of Jimmy Stewart. I love all of his films and his down-to-earth, aw shucks approach to his characterizations. He was a true gem. Last would be Dragnet. As a fan of film noir, Dragnet comes close to creating that same gritty environment on the radio as film noir created on the silver screen." That's my 3 cents, Mark. Chuck, thanks a lot for taking the time to write. So what I'm doing is I'm planning a listener-themed evening on Tune to Yesterday with these suggestions of what shows you want to hear, if there's something special I could bring to the table within the broadcast about your favorite shows. So thanks a lot for taking the time again to write. And if you'd like to get a hold of me about anything, Old Time Radio, Tune to Yesterday, the TTY Dialer podcast, just send me an email.
Letters of encouragement and constructive criticism are always gratefully received. Your criticisms carefully noted, and whenever possible, your suggestions acted upon.
And my address is mark@wrvo.org. That's mark@wrvo.org. So until next week, I hope you enjoy the shows on Tune to Yesterday, and I'll be back with another TTY Dialer. Thanks for listening.